When it comes to plastic surgery, expertise matters, and CAP sets the standard. Our team includes 7 nationally ranked board-certified plastic surgeons. From tummy tucks, breast augmentation, and liposuction to facelifts and beyond, every surgical plan is tailored to your body, goals, and recovery timeline. CAPS is trusted for consistent, visible outcomes. Plus, when you book your surgical consultation, you'll receive a $100 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Expert care, exceptional results. Visit experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step 1, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step 2, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step 3, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step 4, unleash your excitement.
Woo-hoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
By law, 21 plus, terms and conditions apply.
The story you're about to hear on Love, Lust, Fear is true. Some names, places, and other identifying details may have changed to protect the storyteller. Love, Lust, Fear may contain graphic language and depictions of sensitive situations. Please listen with caution. Next on Love, Lust, Fear.
Because I grew up with safe boys, I think I always was very comfortable around the boys. And so I didn't see the threat because there wasn't one. It was when I was around 11 years old. That was the first time that I became aware of my physical presence having any form of attraction to the male gaze. I didn't know what to do with that. The fashion industry became an outlet. That became a way to explore that and be myself. I felt really good at the time. But I was also lonely. I didn't have relationships. I went through another transitional phase of, okay, well, I want a real relationship. And I'm still kind of hung up on my ex, and then realized that I wasn't going to be able to get back together. And so I decided to end that. And then I started dating. And to make me feel safe, he invited his best friend and another woman over. You know, he presented as, I'm a safe guy. And then this unknown individual who I've never met before and turned out to be his drug dealer. Cocaine was his drug of choice. And then he was sitting in the passenger seat and he just grabbed my hair and grabbed my whole skull and smashed it into the driver's side window. The whole world froze. And then I, you know, went upstairs and it started an altercation, and he then started getting physical and he didn't stop. And it was about 3 to 4 hours of nonstop beating. He did things that people who do torture to other people do.
From an early age, Kate was surrounded by men who prided themselves on keeping her safe. Her father, her brothers, even her mother helped create a world where Kate believed she was protected. But something was happening to Kate that would change the way the world saw her, long before she was ready for it. She developed early, maturing physically before her peers. And with that came something she couldn't control, the male gaze. Despite growing up surrounded by protection, Kate became vulnerable to threats she had never been taught to expect. In her late teens, she dreamed of leaving her native Canada, becoming a model and seeing the world. And she succeeded. But success couldn't fill the loneliness. Kate wanted companionship, someone comforting, someone safe. Then a man came into her life who seemed to be exactly that. Trustworthy, protective, familiar. But before long, Kate would find herself trapped in a relationship with an abusive drug addict. The man she once looked to for protection would instead push her to the brink of death.
I was born in Southern Ontario, medium-sized city called Guelph. Born into a very loving home, parents who were married, who were starting to build their life. I was an oops, as my mom likes to say. I learned through my mother, because she's a force of nature, and she's a very strong, independent, of course she was married, but very intelligent. My dad is very supportive of everything that she does. My parents were always very transparent and didn't hide a lot from us, and shared a lot of their darkest times and their own personal experiences in childhood.
I was raised to not really experience extreme gender differences. I was encouraged. I played every single sport known to mankind. I was a swimmer. I was on the synchronized skating team. I also played on a guys' hockey team. I was treated fairly and equitably, and I was still a girl, but I was allowed to explore whatever interests I had. And my brothers equally the same. Because I grew up with safe boys, I think I always was very comfortable around the boys. And so I didn't see the threat because there wasn't one. So that didn't make sense to me to have any hatred for guys. When I was around 11 years old, that was the first time that I became aware of my physical presence having any form of attraction to the male gaze. I've been very tall, I was taller than my grade 5 teacher, and my physical presence in the world, I didn't know what to do with that. My parents wanted to keep me innocent, obviously, but I stood out because of my height and features. And the first time I was 11 years old, a man of who knows what age was leering at me. And my mom rolled down the window and said, "Take a fucking picture, it'll last longer." I think it made my parents nervous, but they didn't know how to navigate that. I was then targeted. The first time I was assaulted when I was 13 or 14, that was sort of my first experiences with sexuality and boundary crossings. It's actually a family member at Thanksgiving, an uncle's brother. And I just knew that it was wrong and it was uncomfortable. And so I told my parents right away. My parents did end up going to the police to file a report. I also didn't want to proceed with charges or anything because I didn't know what to do. That's a really scary thing to ask a person. And then I was date raped by a peer of mine at a party, and that was in grade 10. And then I ended up transferring schools, and then I was shortly thereafter assaulted by a photographer. I didn't know what to do. I didn't understand boundaries. It was difficult. I developed an eating disorder and a manifestation of trauma. And I think because of that first incident of abuse, I was trying to figure out what those were. And I was trying to explore that. I just wanted to get out of Canada so badly. I liked the fashion industry. And so the fashion industry became an outlet. That became a way to explore that and be myself. So I fast-tracked through high school, university, and had gallivanted all over the world for 5 years afterwards. So I have an amazing mother, Adrienne Lepage, and she is, you know, one of the most ethical, top-notch, lovely human beings, but dedicated mother agents and former models. So she understands the industry inside out, and she built my career. And I went everywhere: India, South Africa, all over Europe, the States, Dubai. It was constant. I was 20 years old. I already had a degree. It was an adventure. It was just a continuation of childhood adventures, everything I wanted. I identified with it really strong, but I was just trying to get lost somewhere else. My suitcase was split half winter, half summer, because I didn't know what hemisphere I was going to be in. I felt really good at the time. But I was also lonely. I didn't have relationships. They don't last, you know, people last 3 months and then they're off doing the next thing. I was going through a really big transition, and I think it was a lot of self-discovery. I got into a relationship when I was 25, when I came back to Toronto, and that sort of kept me there, but I was in the States constantly. I think 1 year I took 42 flights to the US or something. You know, I was back and forth all the time, and it was still enjoyable. I still loved everything that I was doing. I was working well. That's when I would start Star Trek and Handmaid's Tale, American Gods, and all of these shows, and they're all shooting in Canada, so that was all great. The thing is, I grew up a bit. I wanted to get married, and I was in a relationship, but he was still not divorced, and there was, you know, a whole bunch of things there. And so I just finished New York Fashion Week, and I came back from, then was in another job in Miami, and then the whole world shut down. And when COVID hit, that split into a million pieces and everything went crazy for everyone. I went through another transitional phase of, okay, well, I want a real relationship. I'm really serious about a relationship and, you know, maybe starting a family with someone. I really want to find my person. I met him on November 21st, 2020. It was the last night before lockdown in Toronto. I went out for dinner with a girlfriend in Yorkville where I lived. And then I ended up at his house because he was having a house party and was more interested in his dog, Lucky, who I took for a walk in the middle of the snow and everyone else was partying or whatever. And I was just playing with the dog. And I went home. And I just didn't really have any interest in him, and I was still kind of hung up on my ex, and then realized that I wasn't going to be able to get back together with my ex in any capacity. It wasn't going to happen. And so I decided to end that, and then I started dating. Our first date was at his kitchen table, and to make me feel safe, he invited his best friend and another woman over. You know, he presented as, I'm a safe guy. I said, oh, okay, that's very good. This is taking extra measures. He was COVID, so he had flown in some COVID tests to COVID test everybody to ensure that no one had it. You know, he really played into my mom really hard with that because she was very nervous about COVID. I was less so. He really hooked her with that, being like, oh, he's safe. He's creating a safe environment. He's going the extra mile. He cares about society. Then in May, my birthday, we had a private dinner. And I had all my girlfriends over and we were, you know, enjoying ourselves or whatever. And then this unknown individual who I've never met before, this big dude walks in and Mike's like, well, this is my personal trainer. I'm like, why are you bringing your personal trainer to my birthday party? It's a bit weird. And turned out to be his drug dealer. Cocaine was his drug of choice. And I don't like this. I can't control people. It's my birthday. And so that was a party favor there, I guess. And so I woke up on Sunday and I said, okay, party's over. Like, that's enough. And let's get back to normal. I was fine resorting back to not drinking and just being healthy and go. I thought life was just going to go back to how it was. And he could not stop. A couple of days later after the party, and he was just like, I need drugs now. And I'm like, what do you mean you need drugs? Like, no, that's insane. And that's what he wanted. And then the gun started getting put to my head of, well, if you don't participate in using this with me, we're going to have problems. I don't like this. I don't want to do this. Please stop. And for some context, he's 6'3", 220, 30 pounds, a big guy. And so that's when the wheels started coming off the bus. And then the first time he was physically violent, we had guests over for, you know, a small pool party or whatever in the backyard, May 29th. He got so ragingly intoxicated that he attempted twice to throw a pool chair over in the neighbor's adjacent yard. We stopped him twice. And then the third time he was successful because no one was literally babysitting him. And so he started an argument with the neighbors because he whipped a lawn chair over at them. And that was a whole altercation. And then he grabbed a mason jar and smashed it on the pool deck. So there's glass everywhere. I started to clean and I was worried about the dog. I mean, obviously everyone's feet and all of those things. And I was cleaning up the glass and he kicked me into the glass. And that started a war between him and his male friends, which then turned into a fist fight. And then everyone scattered. And that was sort of the first time that I was very thrown off by this type of behavior. I did go over to the neighbor's house during that time to kind of regroup. And of course, I got lambasted by him for doing that and being a traitor or whatever else. It was pretty alarming. It's like, oh, you're brazen. Like, you have no... You're not trying to isolate this or hide this behind closed doors. You are on display. So that was May. And then, of course, he felt very guilty for his behaviors in front of everyone at this party and getting in a fist fight with his buddy. And he apologized profusely. He really started to, like, okay, well, I'll buy you this, or let's go on vacation, or, and I said, okay, so we'll go on vacation. So we went to Quebec in June, and that was the first time he really hit me.
We were at the RVZ guy's house, met his frat house, and you know, all of these things. And I was paraded around as, this is the woman you can get if you do successful things in life. And then we were hanging out at Will's house and, you know, just having a good time. Like, obviously got way too drunk. And then he wanted to drive home or drive back to the hotel. And I said, no, you cannot. That is not what's happening here. Like, I'm not comfortable with that. And then I was going to finally let him drive and maybe take an Uber or something like that. And then his buddy interfered and said, Mike, you're not driving. And then he finally listened. And so they will listen to other men. They will listen to other abusers, but they will not ever listen to a woman, even if she's saying the exact same thing. Then I drove us back to the hotel and we were debating whether or not to go get some more food or something. And then he was sitting in the passenger seat and he just grabbed my hair and grabbed my whole skull and smashed it into the driver's side window. The whole world froze. I did not understand what was happening and did not know what to do and had never been treated like this before. And I just was so stuck on his behavior, and I froze. And I just said, okay, well, I guess that's that. And he didn't apologize. Nothing was really said. And it was terrifying. It hurt like hell, but it also it made me really nervous. And in that moment, the decision to not continue the altercation and to just try to make him happy and try to keep the peace was the best decision that I could have made at the time. And then we went back into the hotel and effectively fell asleep. Our vacation was in Chelsea, Quebec, and then we went back to Ontario, and it kind of seemed to subside, but he didn't stop drinking. And so I was living in a constant daily, what is going to happen every single day. It just, you never knew. You had no idea. And he would start hiding it, and then he would be fine for a week. And then this is someone who, when I say drink, I'm not saying, oh, we're having a few cocktails and it goes overboard or whatever. I'm saying pours a half a bottle, half of a 2-6 or a vodka into a cup, slugs it back and takes a shot of 7-Up. Dangerous. So that was sort of the cycle. And then there were incidences where he was drunk and he smashed my face. Like he slapped me across the face. There was always a verbal onslaught. I remember one time I went to go get my nails done underground, you know, cause it was COVID, and he has a lifetime ban from this bar called St. Louis from the Yonge Street location. And so we were there, his buddies were there. He was sitting outside of the bar, outside of the patio, while his buddies were sitting in the patio, and he was drinking with them. And I was getting my nails done, and I'm like, this is crazy. Like, who gets a lifetime ban from a pub? Like, it's not even a fine establishment. It's a regular old, you know, deep fried garbage pub. And what does one have to do to achieve this medal? So, and then he suddenly flipped. Everything was fine. And then he suddenly flipped and started verbally onslaughting me for hours, just abuse after abuse, after abuse, after abuse. And that was the cycle. And so that was June. He started, there was one time in July, I was getting ready to film Night Shoot. And he said he was going to the personal trainers. It was 4 o'clock-ish, 5 o'clock-ish in the afternoon. I was at home with his son. And he came back and he was plastered drunk. And I don't know what made him rageful, but he picked up a dinner plate and threw it to the other side of the room just over his son's head, and it shattered. And then he wanted to leave the house again. And I told him he was not to be drinking. I don't care where you go, but you are not to be drinking and driving. This is a neighborhood of children and you are not, you know, it's my civil responsibility to ensure that you don't. And he hit me in front of his kids, smashed me in the driver's side door. He had open alcohol in the car in front of his son. And his son's mother came and picked him up, and I hadn't disclosed anything to anyone. I was really trying to figure out how to safely leave. A couple nights later, I was on night shoots again. He had a bunch of women over to the house. God only knows what they were doing. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. I ended up having a panic attack on set, was hospitalized for that. And then the doctor asked me, you know, my vitals are fine, but I literally could not physically stop shaking. My nervous system was so whacked. And the doctor looked at me and he said, "What's going on at home?" And then I just burst into tears. And that's when it should have been intervened on properly. But I waited for about 12 hours for a social worker who never showed up, and I was had to go home. And then 2 weeks later, I was nearly dead. It was the same sort of cycle. He was fine. Him and his son went race car driving. I was working, just trying to, again, keep the peace. And just sort of set the scene here. You know, I'm a tall woman. I'm naturally thin, but I was about 110 pounds at 5'10 and a half. I was eating, but my body was so reactive to the environment that I was so stressed out that I couldn't keep weight on. And my body knew before I was willing to cognitively recognize how much of a threat I was, how dangerous I was, the situation I was really in. And then I was shooting nights again. There was a lot of night shoots that month on a different project, end of July. And I came home at 8 o'clock in the morning on July 31st. It was a Saturday because I got night shoots. And I could just tell something was off, but I was obviously so tired. He answered the door and he was relatively calm and friendly, but I could tell he'd been using drugs and been up all night or whatever. And I was just like, "Hey, I got to go to bed. I'm just exhausted." And I went to bed and I woke up and made him lunch or whatever. And then he had been drinking and all those other things while I was sleeping. And then he could not find his car keys and he lost his mind on me. It started around 4-ish in the afternoon. And it was weird because I took a picture of the lunch that I made him for some reason, and I'm not sure why. But I think, again, the subconscious part of me was reading the energy. And he then started burning my handbags on the stove. He lit the stove up and was just holding them over the flame. And that obviously ensued an argument and, you know, begging to stop and those types of things. And then I, you know, went upstairs and it started an altercation, and he then started getting physical and he didn't stop. And it was about 3 to 4 hours of nonstop beating. And he just was maniacal. He had cornered me in the upstairs part of the house. Every time I tried to go down, it was a warning that the stairs in that house are very sharp. And, you know, you wouldn't want to fall down them on a good day. And he, you know, he did things that people who do torture to other people do. You know, he gouged my eyes out with his thumbs. He, you know, stuck my face into the ground. He hit my head over 100 to 100, like I don't know, hundreds of times. I heard my nose crack. Blood was everywhere. I started documenting. I said 6:09. So again, it's like an hour and a bit into it. He had taken my phone, so I didn't know where it was. And I ran to my laptop and in my office and sent a 2-word WhatsApp message, because that was on my Mac. And that was to a director friend of mine who was the first conversation. It was just the first conversation that was there. And I said, "Please help. PLEFC." And Thankfully, that friend of mine had the wherewithal to believe me on a summer night, on a Saturday summer night. And when I wasn't responding, he called my agents and it's like, well, they'll know where she lives and that'll be a start. And then I took as many photos as I could and videos as I could. And I ran the laptop listening for him coming back up the stairs and, you know, just kind of accepted my fate at some point. You know, I remember he was on top of me and pummeling his fists into my head, and just kind of remember my body sort of giving up, sort of surrendering to that. But like a core part of me of, you know, untouchable things of just love and character and the soul, if you will. He was doing whatever he wanted to do to my body, basically. But that core part, I just remember holding on to that and just letting it go, really. There was nothing I could do. The size, even if I had a black belt, I've talked to my stunt double. I said, you're just significantly, you're an expert in all martial arts and, you know, trained and all this. She's like, Kate, it doesn't, his size, his weight, his intent, there's nothing you can really do unless you somehow disable him. And so that was that. And then he went downstairs at one point and got the wooden rolling pin and beat me with that. Split my head open on a door well. It was horrific. Just wanted to record it in case I didn't make it so that they'd know. So, because there's a chronological report. And I didn't know what was going to happen. I lost consciousness at some point. And apparently, I don't remember doing this, but apparently I called my agent because I finally found a device that I could call. And I FaceTimed her. And then she had already called the police. So they were already on their way. But he went out and walked the dog covered in my blood. Yeah. Just complete. I don't like to throw around, you know, I'm not a doctor. You know, I don't like to. Psychopath comes to mind. That's fair. I'm not here to call names or diagnose people, but really so when the police showed up, he was actually out and you could see them on the house camera. So then he went on the run for a few days. He evaded law enforcement for 2 or 3 days because he knew it was a long weekend, because that first long weekend in August is always a civic holiday on the Monday in Canada and or in Ontario or whatever. And so it was Saturday night. So he knew that if he went and turned himself in, he wouldn't get looked at by a judge until Tuesday. So he didn't want to spend a couple nights in jail. So he waited. Like, that's how much he knows the system. You know, he was gone. I then managed to find all my devices. So I had communications with him. The police, he started texting me because he could see them on the Ring camera. And he said, I will kill your family and you if you let the police in. So there goes in my concussed, split open, covered in my own blood, in House of Horrors. I go, I'm not letting the police in. Okay, I believe you. So it took them, they surrounded the house. They weren't sure if I was there or not. I mean, again, I was kind of in and out of consciousness. I heard them. I saw the sirens. There was one after the other, then the ambulance. And I remember going to the front window and just giving them sort of a proof of life that I was actually there. I couldn't hear them, obviously, but I have seen the body cam footage and they had no idea. They were actually going to leave. And then the neighbors begged them to stay, saying, yeah, she's home. She's actually home. And he lied to the police and told them that he was in Quebec. And he had no idea what was going on. And, you know, just lie after lie after lie. And so I was so scared to let them in because I had just seen what he had just texted me. It fascinates me how idiotic these guys are too. Like, why would you text something like that? Like, that's a guaranteed charge. Like, I'm sorry. That's if you're in Quebec, why are you texting me that you're going to kill my family? Like, that doesn't make any sense. It's not funny, but it's just so dumb. The miracle came. So I wouldn't let them in. I was also for the aforementioned reasons. And then they were persistent enough. And there was actually one, they started surrounding the house. So there's a front entrance, there's a side entrance. And I told them, I will talk to you on the side entrance because I know we can hear us on the Ring camera. So I told them to go around the side. And then there's a back entrance as well. And so this officer, who I remember everything physically about him, I don't know what his name is. I need to find him to actually thank him. But he was so gentle. And I saw on the body cam footage that he was actually the one. The woman officer wanted to leave and was done with the situation, being like, well, she knows we're here. If she wants anything, like, we can't do anything about this. And the guy was like, no, this is bad. He made the choice to say, no, I think this is going to get worse if we don't intervene now. And he very gently, you know, I was screaming at him too. I was just yelling, just screaming. And he was very calm and very soothing. And I remember locking eyes with him, and he put his boot gently in the door so I couldn't shut it anymore, and just was kind of the voice of reason. And then they thought it was a hostage situation because I was so reluctant, and in their training, which is the right thing to do, you know, they called their Sarge and they deployed the tactical team because they didn't know if he was still in the house. And if they, because a lot of survivors will lie and the guy will still be in the house and then he'll kill them after. And so they were nervous about that, which is entirely the right thing to do. But that was, the tactical team came, they surrounded the house. I still wasn't letting anyone in. And then they said, okay, well, we're going to break down all these doors if you don't let us in. And then I was like, I'm going to get sued. Like that, like in all of this, that was my moment of like logic and reason, which actually was so irrelevant, but actually the thing that allowed me to just open the doors. So I was like, he's going to sue me. And I was like, okay, like, I don't know. Like, it just doesn't even, none of it makes sense. And then I said, okay, I let them in, and they came in with vengeance. They were just, that was terrifying in and of itself. You know, you go through something like that, you're in the state that you're in, and now you've got seven dudes with giant guns just plowing through your house and like going up in an attic that you didn't even know existed, and ladders and just utter, and it was wild. And they saw everything. I mean, it's all documented. It's obviously all on body cam footage. And they were just, I think, horrified. I think it was, you know, they're real heroes. They really, you know, they really, really, really cared. And I was told, because I was conscious at this point, I was told that I needed to go to the hospital, which I 100% did. But I refused medical attention because for whatever reason in that state, I was so concerned about my family, and I was so concerned to engage with authorities in any capacity because I wasn't sure if he was going to go kill them. And so my logic and reasoning in that time, my survival was make sure that you have eyeballs on him. And he went to a house party. After I refused medical attention and they begged and pleaded me, I said, no, I'm fine. And it's like, they're like, you need to go to a doctor. I'm like, no. And I'm like, blood's coming out of my head. And they're just, nope. And so they finally, well, the police didn't leave. The ambulance left. They left because a warrant obviously went out for his arrest pretty quickly. And so they parked up at his house here, and they parked up at his other house in the same neighborhood. And then I lied to them and said I was going to a girlfriend's house, and I went and found him at the house party that he was at. And he was already corralled in the back guest house because he was causing issues with the guests at the party. And I showed up covered like that, and I had done my best to hide all of the bruising and everything like that. And everyone was like, what is going on here? And apparently, and I found this out relatively recently, but apparently he had come into the house just raging and had tried to cut someone up with a razor blade, had said a whole bunch of profane racial slurs, and was just a maniacal mess. So a continuation of the behavior that he had shown me. And then we crashed there for the night. I took the dog and then he went on the run and went and stayed at wherever various people's houses. And I then, when I had him, I went back to the house, which was very weird. It was covered in these types of injuries, and go back into the house and you just see the mayhem and you see your blood all over the house. And it just, that was the moment where it all kind of logic and reasoning came back online. And I had a moment of quiet to myself and I sat in the guest room and I just finally felt pain. The adrenaline finally shut off and I was like, oh, I'm hurt. I'm really hurt. And so I then drove myself to the hospital. Like, completely 9 o'clock in the morning. And I texted him and I said, I'm having a change of heart. I'm going to the hospital. Is my nose broken? And so I drove myself to the hospital and they immediately, I mean, it wasn't that far. It was only 10 minutes or so, but I should not have been driving. That's for damn sure. But yeah, I then was corralled in a room and they CAT scanned my entire body top to bottom because I was black and blue head to toe. There was everything but my neck. There was open wounds on my feet, on my hands, on my skull, on my back, bruises. Like, there was very little. So then my left arm was from above the elbow down to the tips of my fingers, completely black and blue and purple. There was not a patch of normal skin. And yeah, I somehow didn't break anything. Nothing. He didn't break a single bone in my body. I think he messed with my jaw a little bit, but he didn't break anything. And I think it's because I surrendered to it. I didn't fight. I wasn't tense. I at some point just collapsed into it and just said, okay. And I think, you know, it's that adage of, okay, well, why do drunk drivers not get injured as much as the sober victim? Because your body doesn't tense up. So I think I just let it go. I think that actually saved me from having to have any bones or anything be in a cast. So he was charged 8 times, 3 times in Superior Court for the historical abuse. He should have been on federal, like the federal charges, but he was not. They were provincial charges. And for the majority of them, the Crown Attorney, I believe, didn't even open the file. Mark Friedman is the Crown Attorney's name. He couldn't answer basic questions about my case. And he had more evidence than you could ever desire to convict someone of at least something. The police were going to consider it an official attempted murder, but the burden of proof that you need in Canada to actually get a conviction there is incredibly high. So they were more concerned about just getting him on something than trying to go after the big fish, because the Canadian system is so broken. When he finally turned himself in early August, he was let out on bail for $500 the next day. So he then was let back into the house. I hadn't told my parents yet. And I was trying to process this and withdrawn the restraining order. And then I didn't know how to, I was so numb and so physically sick and so scared. And it was so complicated and I didn't know what to do. And then finally I locked myself in the movie theater room and drank like 3 vodka neutral, whatever things, and called my brother. Like I could not emotionally get past saying the words out loud. And then my brother obviously freaked out and was like, why the hell are you in that house? Like, get out now. And then that's what ended up saving me. My parents came and got me the next day, immediately, as soon as they knew. And so it should have been handled. That's a big problem in Canada. The Bill C-75 that the Liberal Party put in, they catch and release policies with these guys all the time. He started stalking me about 30 days later. It was August 30th and I had gone out for lunch with someone and she was talking about him because she had been involved in the situation and she had been my friend through it. And then she's like, well, you know, he's going to pay your friends off to testify against you. I'm like, that's a really weird thing to say. You're the only person, and I'm like, this friendship is over. And then he drove by And I'm like, you told him where I was. Like, this is way too coincidental. And so he started showing up and I was like, I got to get out of here now. And I put the American border between us. And had I not, I wouldn't be here. He won't touch me in this country because he knows he'll go to jail. He knows he'll be held accountable. And especially because it's so public now, if like the wind blows my hair the wrong direction, like everyone knows that it's him. It's so important that we repeal that law in Canada. I mean, it's killing us. It's literally killing us. And I've been arguing with the Liberal Party and the NDP about this for a year, and they don't want to budge on it. And it's sinful. It's equally as reprehensible as being abusive. It's like, how are you allowing these guys to do this? It makes me crazy. So the bail was the first failure in the justice system. The fact that I have literally a video, a recording of all of this. I could show, it's a movie. I have the movie. And I still have never had a criminal trial because his charter rights, his right to a speedy trial, it timed out. And all of his charges disappeared twice. They did it in the provincial court and then in the three other charges. And when that happened on December 16th, 2022, when they stayed the first set, that changed everything for me. Because I had already warned them that they had scheduled trial outside of this deadline. I had already warned the Crown attorneys. I told them how to do their job. I told the officer in charge this was wrong and he's going to use this again. And they said, we would never stay something of this nature. We would never throw something like this out. And they did. And so I started documenting everything. I started recording my meetings with the Crowns. My family retained a private lawyer to babysit the Crown attorneys, Corey Langdon and Mark Friedman. And they lied. I caught them in multiple lies. I caught them in so much overpromising and underdelivering, and I have it all recorded. And Corey Langdon told me she'd follow through the last charges till the end. You know, we have to get this guy, blah, blah, blah. And then in January 2024, she said, okay, we're just going to give a restraining order for this, put it on a peace bond, and, you know, just move on with your life. All the charges are disappearing. I said, are you? I lost it. And that's when I decided, okay, well, I told them, I said, we're going to do this my way from now on. We are not doing this your way because your way doesn't work. I am going to go public with this story and we are going to see what happens. I had no intention of having an organization. I had no intention of this becoming such a major part of my life, but I didn't expect it to be this political. I didn't expect to be invited into these political, but I was, because I realized that is such an essential part of advocacy. I mean, I can raise $1 billion tomorrow. I can have 1,000 conversations about this, but unless we change the laws, it doesn't matter. So founding End Violence Everywhere, Eve, that was just the next best thing to do. And that was just the next right thing to do, was to take all, I was in and out of Toronto, I don't know, 7 or 8 times in 7 months. And I hate being there. I hate it because he's free, but I needed to do that. And I've spoke at Queen's Park and House of Commons. And I'm now very involved in politics because it is actually bad policy created by the Trudeau Liberals and the Supreme Court of Canada that actually has caused all these problems. Like, they are solely responsible for how these situations have been mishandled. I just do the next best thing. There's no master. I know how to, from all my years of modeling, from all my years being in the entertainment industry, I know how business works. It was actually my brother who said, you should formulate this into a charity. This makes sense. I know how to get eyeballs on things. So there's a lot of natural, there's a lot of transferable skills from those industries. I know how to build brands because I've sold brands my entire life. And this is something so worth doing and using all of those skills I'm not really afraid to go toe to toe with people who think they're celebrities or people who are in powerful places. I mean, we were shooting Happy Gilmore on the weekend yesterday and Adam's a great dude. Like, I don't really care, you know, like I none of that is scary to me because that's just my life anyways. And so
I think that's really where it's important that we have people like Cassie in the Diddy situation, and people who like Evan Rochelle Wood and who say, no, enough. Like, we're not doing this way. I think it's so important because that changes culture. And we're asking for a cultural shift here, particularly in Canada, where we don't have a justice system. And I'm not famous. Like, there's no, people don't know who I am. That's not like, that's, and that's okay. But this was within the access to all of these types of, like, I think it's really important to be truthful and to be honest. We'll have a better shot if we all work together. I have a partner now. We had met 17 days after my attempted murder. So I was obviously not in any particular state to be a normal, balanced, and healthy person. We have recently rekindled our relationship after about an 8-month hiatus, because the recovery process it can be arduous, and it doesn't happen overnight. And the court system obviously did not assist with the recovery process. It made everything worse. And so I was not in a really good state, but I want people to know that they can heal. I want people to know that there's therapies and modalities, and that people, it's entirely possible. And it is more probable if you take the necessary steps, EMDR, as I've said, myofascial therapy, somatic therapy, yoga, basic fundamental physiology of drink enough water, exercise, try to get enough sleep, you know, use pharmaceuticals if you need them. I used to be on Prozac. I'm no longer on any medication at all. You know, it's really possible. And heal your nervous system. And get into that, and don't shy away from your feelings about it. Experience the feelings. The more you stuff things and try to shelve things, the more they will sit there and rot. So I think in relation to others, I was going through something really, it was so difficult. I was not okay. Understandably, the world was different. I was different. I'm now getting back into that stride. I now have hope and feel kind of like I did before. And so how that affects it, of course that affects an interpersonal relationship. I don't think you should be in a relationship immediately after going through something like that. I think you can have friends, you need the support, you should not isolate, but it takes a bit of time, and pay attention to what people are showing you. And trust, give that, but you also can't bring in, it's not fair to your partner to bring in the trauma of the other relationship, which I was doing a lot because I wasn't past it or healed from it. And I didn't understand it, or I don't think I'll ever fully understand it, but you have to take the time to heal, and you have to be doing good things for yourself. You have to be okay on your own before you start getting into partnership. And survivors make amazing partners because they generally are very empathetic and very kind, and they're more weary of the world because they notice things that other people wouldn't necessarily notice. And so they, you know, and they can be really, but they also need patience. And so I think I also say to the guys, you know, don't be afraid to, most women have trauma. Most women have been through some version of something. And so don't hold that against her. That's the absolute worst thing that you can do. And you don't even deserve to be there if you want to make her accountable for that. It's really important to have patience, and to, I think also the right partner can help you heal too, when you're ready, when you're able to be stable on your own. And that's really, I think the right person will help you look at those shadowy parts of your life and walk you through them. So
when I sat down with Kate, I asked her more about her original desire to escape Canada. Looking back now, is there a clear picture of what was really motivating that need to leave?
What I realized now, I was really running away from the pain and suffering of being abused multiple times in multiple situations. I think looking back, my mom didn't want me to be beautiful or to be that, because she didn't want me to get hurt anymore.
Kate went into more detail about the perpetrator and the abuse she had experienced.
Something to note actually is the photographer when I was 17, 18 years old, who assaulted me and about 12 other women that we know of. So he was actually, it took 8 years to get through the system, but he was finally convicted of all of his offenses and went to jail for 3 years or whatever. So I also spent all of my 20s dealing with the criminal system, but I was far enough away from it to not engage with it that much, but it was still hard. And so that finally wrapped up in March 2019, I think. I can't exactly even remember the year. So much has happened. And then 2020 happened, and then I did some soul searching. I went to therapy. I wanted to figure out myself and be, you know, figure out who I was in those times, and you know, wanted to be in a partnership. And I actually, by the end of 2020, was in a really, really good place. It was, I know the world was on fire and everyone was in tumultuous situations constantly, but I had found a bit of a stride. I found a bit of myself again, and then I met Shithead, as we called him. started dating Michael Golovka, and he presented himself as the father of the year, wanted a relationship, you know, very a provider, a protector, he presented himself as a sober person. Oh, wow, this is everything that I could have dreamed of and more. And for 5 months, it stayed that way. I mean, my family thought we were all going to get married. He was just like, you know, you're the woman of the house, you know, this is it when we get married, et cetera, et cetera. And then the abuse started shortly after my birthday in May 2021, and it went downhill from there. So we had been living, you know, free of any substances for about 5 months from January to May. And I mean, that was neither here nor there with me. I didn't realize that he's someone that really, really, really can't drink. And so on my birthday, we had a private chef over at the house, you know, still COVID. So that's a factor in it, right? I think his ex-wife probably went through something, but that particular situation, his ex-wife and his son, but we inherently have a sisterhood that we, yeah, because we get him. We know like there, yeah. Oh, he's doing that. Okay. We know what's coming next. That level of violence is very, thankfully it's very rare, but if it's unchecked, they only double down on it. There's no place of that level of violence in any aspect of my life. We weren't allowed to watch violent television programs as a kid. So the odds are very, and this is why it's so important to share all stories to end the stigmatisms against these issues, because it literally can happen to anybody. I know that I was told by one of the female officers that came, who wasn't even really supposed to be there because she was in special crimes, and she's a survivor herself, and she kind of took me under her wing and sort of got me to finally tell my parents, because it took me a week. And she told me, she's like, this is one of the 5 worst domestics I've ever seen in my 30-year career. She's like, this is bad. This guy is dangerous, and he's going to do it again. I'm like, I know he is. I'll tell you right now.
I asked her about how she continues to heal and cope with her trauma, what advice she would offer others, and her decision to speak publicly.
You have to be very careful not to become your trauma. So that's why I always make sure to ensure that I'm, you know, doing my creative activity. I mean, I like painting watercolor, you know, like always make sure that you have other things going on. And I think I've leaned actually harder into my artistic career because I need that as a lifeline so that I'm not absorbed by this every single day. And I really used music as an outlet, and I really used songwriting as an outlet. And nobody knew because I wasn't allowed to talk about it because it was in the criminal system, and nobody knew until after all the charges were staked. So I felt like I had this big, giant secret, and it was so liberating to be able to share it publicly. And I'm so grateful for every single media outlet. I have not had a problem with any of them. They've all been so respectful and kind and inquisitive, but gentle. And I mean, I like the tough questions, but they gave me freedom again, because now everybody knows. And I had already consulted with my parents. I consulted with all my management. And I just said, what are we going to do with this? And it was actually Peggy Lepage, my mother agent. And she said, own it. Just own it. And that was the best decision ever, because now I get to show up in the room, and you already know I've lost jobs because of this. I was supposed to be in The Apprentice. I was cast. It was originally written as a Marla Maples character.
And finally, I ask her to expand about her vision for ending violence everywhere, Eve, what she hopes to achieve through her advocacy, and the impact she hopes to make through the organization.
I mean, we've grown so quickly in such a short period of time. We're in the States and in Canada. We're a nonprofit, registered nonprofit in both countries. Our charity status is pending. That is up to the IRS and CRA. That's just a waiting game. It's kind of dumb. But it's so annoying, actually. It's, you know, you just process the paperwork. You know, we need to create billions of dollars here. We have access to that. Like, let us do that. So we've grown so quickly. We've helped over 80 survivors. We officially sort of started in December. And in the last sort of 5 months alone, I've been able to really be there for a lot of people, help them, you know, move from one side of the country to the other. So we're supporting a survivor in Minnesota who's had a really dangerous time in tribal court. We're supporting a survivor at the Diddy trial. We will be there. We've been providing EMDR. We're starting up our yoga, online trauma yoga program for everyone. You know, whether it's food, housing, legal issues, we are kind of that one-stop shop. And so what I noticed I never really accessed services other than going to PTSD treatment, but a lot of services do one thing really, really well, but then you're engaging with seven different organizations and it's, you know, it's complicated. And so I really wanted to make that simple. Be like, okay, this is when you're in trauma, you need someone to take the reins. You need someone that you trust who says, oh, okay, you have this problem. Okay, here's the alarm. Okay, you need food. Okay, here's a $250 gift card. Okay, you need to move from this to that. Okay, let's get you across the country. And someone to do all of that sort of administrative, logical, labor intensive, so you can process, so you can be supported. And we've been providing that at no cost to survivors. So we have a board therapist who's licensed in states in the US and all across Canada. And she provides group EMDR for everyone. And the feedback from the survivors has been incredible. They're saying it's life-changing. Thank you so much. You know, just like any nonprofit, more resources are always better. That's always it. We've been doing really well with our fundraising. We've raised over, I think since inception, over $150,000 in 5 months. So it's not bad. That's just in Canada. The other thing that we're doing differently is we're inviting men into the conversation. It's really, really important for us to have men participate and to have them be a part of the solution. Half our board is male. We have male employees. We really, really want this to be a community effort. And so I think being open to those conversations and opening to dialogue with men and having their support. I mean, we hosted an event called Partners in Purple in Ottawa a couple weeks ago and, you know, spoke to businessmen and banking guys and talked to them. And they're like, oh, this is really worth us helping out. And I was like, this is what we need to hear, because abusers and other men will listen to you guys. You guys need to take lead on this. So we'll like invite you into this conversation instead of ostracizing and pinning the genders against each other. So that's been a huge part of it. I mean, we're just growing at lightning speeds, which is so thrilling and exhausting and incredible. We have an entire department that is focused solely on legislation and government relations, because again, if we don't, there's sort of, I look at it as, yes, you need money. Okay, that's great. We need awareness and education. And we also need the legislation. If we don't, a lot of organizations don't want to touch the legislative part. I think it's so essential that we be intrinsically a part of forming laws or repealing laws or a part of the political process. And that doesn't mean we prop up one particular party, but as far as the bills themselves, yes, we absolutely have to have stake in that. And we absolutely have to be included in that process because we understand this better than anyone will. Survivors are the experts. And that's that. So that's really what we've been doing. And I ask of the public to visit, say hi. You never know, you know,
money's obviously a wonderful thing. There's no shame in asking for it at all. But we've had a lot of lawyers donate their services. That's always welcome, people, because lawyers are expensive. They are bloody expensive. So, you know, we just want everyone to even just come say hi or share something or share their story or, you know, not be in the dark. I really want to reform the Canadian justice system. I really, 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 really want to do that because it can be done and it's very simple. And that's what's so infuriating about the state that it's in, because these are not rocket science. We are not doing open heart surgery. Like this is literally this is not incomprehensible. This is very, very plausible, very accessible. That is one thing I really want to do. I want survivors to know that it's okay to talk about these things. That it's not, no shame. The shame is only on the abuser, only, exclusively. There is nothing you could have done better. You couldn't have poured water to the perfect level. You couldn't have swept the floor again. You couldn't have, you know, fed the dog at 8:31 instead of 8:32. Like there's nothing you could have done better. You can't change them. They are, and that's it. So accept that and move on. I want people to understand that trauma is real. It has a cellular impact on the body and the biology, and it's not something that should just be stuffed down and moved on from, but explored and healed from. And that happens inside out. That happens without avoidance. That happens with acceptance and confrontation and being willing to sit in the uncomfortable. I think legacy happens inevitably when you just wake up and do the next right thing. And that's just a stacking of days. So, you know, I think that'll happen in its own, whatever. I think that'll just happen. I think there's that. I have no set chart for trying to create a legacy. I just want to wake up and do the next right thing and help the next right person and come what may. I've had so many surprises in this sphere over and over and over again. And so I think it's just one day at a time.
Kate barely survived, but for Kate, what he did to her would not define her. She had grown up believing she was protected. Yet when the person beside her became the threat, none of that protection could reach her. In the aftermath, Kate had a choice: let what happened become her story or begin living a new one. Today, she advocates for others, works through Eve to help end violence everywhere, and helps others find the courage to live their own story. Because survival was only the beginning for Kate. What came next is hers to define.
Until next time, I'm Jake Deptula, and this is Love, Lust, Fear. Every guest featured on Love, Lust, Fear selects a charity or organization to share. Please check the show notes on this episode for more details. If you or someone you know is being abused by a partner, there is help available. The National Domestic Violence Hotline provides essential tools and support to help survivors of domestic violence. Just call 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233. Or you can text START to 88788. If you'd like to be a guest on Love, Lust, Fear and share your personal dating or relationship story, you can email us at lovelustfearpod@gmail.com or DM us on Instagram at lovelustfearpod. Disclaimer: the information shared on this podcast should not be considered as professional advice or a substitute for seeking professional advice.
When it comes to plastic surgery, expertise matters, and CAP sets the standard. Our team includes 7 nationally ranked, board-certified plastic surgeons. From tummy tucks, breast augmentation, and liposuction to facelifts and beyond, every surgical plan is tailored to your body, goals, and recovery timeline. CAPS is trusted for consistent, visible outcomes. Plus, when you book your surgical consultation, you'll receive a $100 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Expert care, exceptional results. Visit experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
You know what quality feels like. You can see it in the way a fabric moves, recognize it in a flawless fit, and appreciate it in the details that make our styles unique. It's the standard Coldwater Creek has honored for over 40 years, derived from a rich Mountain West heritage and designed for today in styles that are distinctively Coldwater Creek. For a wardrobe you can count on season after season, visit coldwatercreek.com. Shop new arrivals and save 15% on purchases $75 or more with code IHEART.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.